Okay.
I was thinking about this yesterday, and not that it's wrong or bad or anything like that, but just your set-aside prayer. Wow. Actually, that's the way I learned it, but me being the fighter or pain in the ass that I am, I change things. But I love that prayer because it's I always tell my guys and the people that I work with that prayer is not set in stone. The words don't matter. The meaning does. You know, and I alter that prayer all the time. You know, I walk into a meeting and I ask God to help me to set aside everything I think I know about this meeting and help me have an open mind so I can have a new experience with this meeting and these people and help me to hear the truth. You know, because you know what? If I walk into a meeting that I know is quote unquote dark tunnel meeting, you know, I'm blocked, I'm closed, and that's all I'm going to hear is the crap. If I walk in after saying the set aside prayer and really digesting it and experiencing it, you know, I'll hear that one guy in the room who actually shared something good, you know, or those two guys or five guys. I have. I do. But we're, you know, this Dell of whatever has kind of got us to this place right now. And the thing that jumped out at me this morning was this line or paragraph on page 151. It says, now and then a serious drinker being dry at the moment says, I don't miss it at all. I feel better, work better, having a better time. As ex-problem drinkers, we smile at such a sally. We know our friend is like a boy whistling in the dark to keep up his spirits. He fools himself. Inwardly, he would give anything to take half a dozen drinks and get away with it. He will presently try the old game again, for he isn't happy about his sobriety. He cannot picture life without alcohol. Someday he will be unable to imagine life either with alcohol or without it. Then he will know loneliness such as few do. He will be at the jumping off place. He will wish for the end. You know. And I guess my question here is, you know, if you could drink and get away with it, would you? You know, when I was new, when I was first going into the steps, my answer was absolutely. You know, if I could avoid these consequences, the first question was if you could drink like normal people, would you? And no, I wouldn't. You know, I don't want to drink like normal people. I want to drink like an alcoholic and not have the consequences. Mm-hmm. But that question, if I could drink the way I want to drink and not have the consequences, would I? And in the beginning, yeah, absolutely. You know, I loved what booze did for me. It fixed me. It solved my problem. And, you know, the consequences were the work. I knew how to get what I had to get. That wasn't the work. It was dealing with the wreckage that was the work. And it was kind of difficult to get to this point. But today, if I had a way to magically not have the consequences, I have no desire to drink. I don't want to drink. I like my life. That's the thing. I'm happy with my life. It's got its ups and downs, and it sucks sometimes, but life sucks sometimes. You know, it's just life. But I'm happy. You know, I read a bumper sticker years ago, and I know it's kind of foofy and fluffy and whatever, but it illustrates the point is, serenity is not the absence of chaos. Serenity is peace amidst the chaos. And that's, you know, that's kind of what I got. You know, I'm okay in here. All that shit out there can crumble. It can fall apart, and I can still be okay in here. And I think that's, you know, what's important, because without that, I'm always going to be looking for that magic bullet. I'm always going to be looking for something to make me okay. And there's nothing that will, except my relationship with God and me. You know, so, I'll say something.
And so we wanted to, and like I get the way that we, you know, approach this entire weekend was about, you know, living service, you know, creating a vision of what, you know, of what God wants you to be, and how are we going to get there? You know, access that power more than, you know, more than just saying, okay, well, you know, I'm in AA, everything's good, but, you know, like, how do we become more effective in all the areas in our life? You know, how do we become, you know, because ultimately, if you don't want what you have now, you know, at some point, you're going to want to better deal it. You know, and there's that statement in the book where it talks about it says, you know, have you a sufficient substitute, you know, for alcohol? You know, is it, you know, did your use and abuse leave this huge hole in your life? And are you less of a person, or are you less fulfilled in your life, you know, without it? You know, do you have something? Is your life better today and more fulfilling today than it ever could be? You know, and for most of us, you know, when you're doing this deal and you're truly living this program, the answer is yeah. You know, because our life is full. It's full of people. It's full of love. It's full of service. It's full of, you know, compassion. It's full of, you know, 12-step work is. It's one of those things where, like, you know, you never really know what you're gonna get. And you walk into a situation and you think it's going to be like, oh, this isn't, you know, just normal. I'm going to sit down and read the big book. And then all of a sudden, like, you know, things go kablooey. And, you know, you're dealing with and going with things. And all of a sudden, like, you're like, you feel this sense of power flow into you. And you're saying things that you didn't even know you knew. And all of it. And it's like this magic, you know. So when you're doing this deal, you have all of that stuff. And it's incredible. You know, and I think to myself, it's like, well, if that happens to me when I'm sitting reading this book, where else can it happen? You know, where else can I bring that same magic in my life? Like, why can't I have it in all the areas? Why can't I have it at work? Why can't I have it at school? Why can't I have it with my family? Why can't I have it with my friends? Why can't I have that same energy all places? You know, because service isn't always just about sitting down and reading the big book. You know, service is a holistic thing. It is all about who we are as people. You know, and of course, you know, we're always taught, you know, I'm my problem, you're my solution, and that is an absolute truth. You know, but why limit service to one aspect of it? Say, okay, well, this is what I do. I help drunks, and I'm going to grab newcomers, and that's what I'm going to do. I mean, that's wonderful, and I do that. But there's more to it than that. We can get more and be more if we expand our horizons or expand our vision of what service really means. Is this making sense to you?
The original 12 steps said, having had a spiritual experience as a result, or as a result of this course of action, we carry this message to others. Okay? If we're focused on the booze, then we can't carry this message to others. That's not the message that this book is implying or transmitting. What the message in my view and what I see, the message that this book gives us is this reliance and dependence upon God. Yeah. This world of the spirit and living a life of service. Okay. And that doesn't mean that I'm subservient, but I live a life of service. I bring this thing that we do, this practice, into all of my affairs. There's not an area of my life. And now I'm not telling people that they need to do what I do, but I just, what I do, I don't have anonymity, okay, in my life. I've never felt the need for it. I've never had it. I'm not on television. I'm not on radio. I do, and I'm not in the newspaper. So I adhere to the traditions and currently the change with the internet thing. So my Facebook main page, title page, doesn't say I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous on the web, privately, throughout, you know, stuff like that, but my public profile isn't. But my public profile in my community, there's no anonymity. I'm a member of my community and people know what I do. They know who I am. The best example of this is we lived in Harrison, New Jersey for, I don't know, about 5 years. And we had a house meeting going on and it started off real mellow. It started off with like 4 people, 6 people, something like that. This little step study meeting there. And then all of a sudden these guys were getting excited and they were getting involved in the work and they were finding newcomers. And I was, bring them. You know, our only rule we had children, our only rule is don't bring a sloppy drunk. You know. You
or can a pedophile.
Or a pedophile. You can bring a wet one, but he's got to be contained. You know, he's got to be kind of sedate or whatever. You know, I got no problem with a, with an active junkie sitting on my couch because he's, you know. But, you know, that sloppy drunk, I didn't want my kids around. We made a rule that the kids don't have to interact with sloppy drunks. And what would happen is they'd start to bring these people, and they'd start to bring these people. Then these guys would get into it, and they'd start to bring people. You know, and we're not talking long stretches of time. We're talking weeks. You know, over the course of weeks, this thing grew. And then all of a sudden, we had 25 members of people showing up at our house. You know, and then all of a sudden, the neighborhood started to find out what we were doing. Because, you know, there's 25 people sitting on our steps smoking cigarettes and hanging out and bullshitting on the, you know. And we're in a community at this time. It's one of those neighborhoods where there's no space between the houses. You know, you got just a little alleyway to get to your backyard, and your backyard is this little patch of grass this big, you know. And we're all hanging out on the stoop, smoking cigarettes and talking, and everybody's got big books, and people found out. You know, and the neighborhood knew, and across the street was low-income housing. And all of a sudden, the word started to spread around there, and people who were struggling in our community found out who we were.
Yeah, I'd go in to go pick up my son from kindergarten, and somebody, a woman from our community, who I was 12-stepping at the time, yells across the park, across the playground, I got my kids back! I stopped smoking crack, Carrie! Thank you! My son's kindergarten teacher, I'm like, I don't know who that is. Then later, I've learned, I'm like,
yeah.
I have no problem with people knowing that I'm an alcoholic, but probably for you, you might not want to yell in front of your kids, friends, parents about smoking crack.
You know, and my, you know, I was in a meeting about 6 months ago, and I was talking about this, and the guy, this guy raised his hand, and he asked me, he's like, I have no idea, that makes no sense. He's been in Alcoholics Anonymous for 8 years, and his family doesn't know he's in recovery. And I'm totally baffled, you know. I'm not saying you got to live like me, but there's got to be some kind of integration in your life with this program. You know, and with this way of life, because if it's not, it's like it's trying to intentionally live schizophrenic or something. You know, it's you know, it's how do you have one area of your life be a certain way, and one area of your life be another way? It just doesn't make any sense to me. Again, like I said, not everybody has to do this. I have a friend of mine who his job, you know, he doesn't let anybody know in his job. You know, his boss has come to find out, but, you know, he's quiet about it, and his Facebook, he does, nothing happens on it because they look at it and people know. And that's okay, but he's not afraid to give it out. He just doesn't offer it out, you know. And I think that that's the key. You know, with us, we lived in such a way where it was acceptable. I was a contractor, you know. Nobody cared. You know, people were actually grateful, you know,
that
I wasn't drunk and that I'm living sober. And, you know, my theory was, is they seen me laying in the gutter. You know, why would I hide the fact that I'm not anymore?
Yeah. You know, but when we're, you know, so one of the things, and again, I think that, you know, sometimes, like, as an alcoholic, I get very laser focused and very tunnel visioned with things, and I get a conception, and I create an identity on this conception, and I'm so attached to this identity that I fail to see other possibilities in my life, you know, and you know, when we had talked about, like, the two stepping, you know, about you know, people who work the steps and they do it once, you know, 25 years ago, and they just stick with 12 stepping in service and this, that, and the other thing, and you know, and And, you know, the message that they're carrying has less depth and weight every damn year because they forgot what it was like to make amends. They forgot what it was like to write an inventory because the last time they wrote it was a decade ago, you know. And so, you know, and then there's the other side where you spend all your time navel-gazing and thinking about your own feelings and resentments and trying to hump them into submission and inventory them away, that we fail to be of service because we're so busy working on ourselves, we forget part of working on ourselves is helping somebody else. Mm-hmm. And there's that balance. You know, and so, like, we were thinking about when Tarek asked us, like, what we, you know, what's our specialty? Well, when I get called in to do, you know, big book workshops, there are a couple things that I usually get asked, like, can you do this? It's usually the woman's perspective of the four step, which is, you know, full of prostitution and drunken rods and shame and fear and all of those wonderful things that we like to talk about, you know. So we have that one. We have the more integrated living service because of the way that Adam and I conduct ourselves in our family, with the application of the traditions in our relationship, and just the way that we have, you know, the way that our life has been shaped by this process and our approach to it. And, you know, and of course, the other thing is, I get called in to do stuff on the lost chapters, which is directly related to this living service thing. And, you know, because, you know, a lot of times people stop at working with others and they say, oh, this is all I need to know about, you know, everything else is Al-Anon, so it's irrelevant to me. Guess what? Al-Anon's very relevant to alcoholics because, you know what? None of us would be sitting here without those people.
And how many of you don't associate with alcoholics?
Yeah, by the way, we all qualify for Al-Anon.
We qualify for Al-Anon. You know, you don't have to be a wife or a husband or a family member to need the tools that Al-Anon offers. We deal, at least I deal, with alcoholics on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes my codependent issues come up and they
kick
in.
Did you say issues?
Issues. Yes. Sometimes my codependency comes up and I, you know, I get jammed up. And what addresses this stuff? The stuff that addresses it is the latter chapters of our book, the Al-Anon principles.
Yeah.
You know, and I was told by my sponsor, I was actually ordered by my sponsor at one point that I needed to start attending Al-Anon.
Yeah. You know, and the thing is what we don't realize, and of course you guys probably all know this, but I'll be redundant nonetheless, that for the first 13 years that this fellowship and this program was in existence, there was no Al-Anon that you were expected to bring your family, you were expected to bring your wife. If you did not bring your wife to a meeting, they went and got her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because their theory was like, well, you know, the alcoholic will probably drink, but if we help the wife, maybe he won't, maybe if he does drink, we'll be able to get him back. So it was get him fast, get him hard, get his family, get him now. I mean, one of the things that I do is, for example, when I get called out on a wet drunk call, I mean, I almost always have Al-Anon literature in my car. And I almost always have Al-Anon contacts. You know, I have people that I know who are strictly Al-Anon who work within the program of Al-Anon. So when I get called into a 12-step call in which, you know, I have family members, I give them information too. You know, because it's one thing to help the alcoholic, but why not help the family? Because, again, you know, if we can help the mother, father, sister, brother, the people involved in the alcoholic's life, we're going to have a better chance of keeping their ass in this chair.
Just a good word of advice here. If you're an experienced 12-stepper and you're experienced with wet drunk calls and going to people's houses and things like that, get your newbie guy that's coming with you to work with the drunk because the Al-Anons are much harder to deal with. They really are, you know.
They got that victim persona.
Yeah, no, they're really hard to handle. And the newbie, the guy who's just fresh going on a wet drunk call or been to one or two, whatever, he can handle that alcoholic. He knows the deal, you know. He's excited about it. He's on fire. But, you know, you need somebody with a little tact.
Yeah, the Al-Anon will spin them like a top because that's the thing is like, you know, it's very easy for the alcoholic to say, okay, you know, I'm sitting here in a pile of my own vomit. You know, I just trashed the house and I drunk dialed everybody on my cell phone. I think I have a problem here. There seems to be some sort of unmanageability. You know, for the people in the alcoholic's life, I mean, it's to them, the unmanageability is the alcoholic, you know, and to get them to the point where they realize, well, dude, well, if the unmanageability is the alcoholic, why are you sitting here? Mm-hmm. You know, if the problem is the alcoholic, why is the problem still the alcoholic? Why are you still allowing the alcoholic continue to be a problem? There's something to that. We need to take a look at that. And it's funny because I don't like doing women's conferences. No offense, guys. I hate women's meetings. I have not set foot in, I don't remember. I said 12 years, but I really don't know. I think it's gotta be. Like, I think they threw me out of it. I think that my first year, they threw me out of the women's meeting, and I never really went back, and I don't think I've ever sat in an actual women's meeting since I was about a year or year and a half sober. I mean, like, they drove my, what?
You did the women's conference.
They had these women conferences, like this thing that, you know, that's been this movement going on. So they invited me to this woman to women's conference, and I was like, shit, I got a women's conference, I hate women, and it's in Kansas. Fuck. I'm like, woman to women's conference in, like, you know, LA maybe, but Kansas, really?
Dorothy,
what are we doing there? Exactly. So I'm like, crap. And then I find out that it's Al-Anon and AA, and then I'm like, I'm not so bad about that, because I'm like, okay, I get some Al-Anons there. They'll be interesting. You know? Because I love picking Al-Anon's brains. I ask them all kinds of questions. I've done the Al-Anon four-step. I mean, I'm all about, like, and what do you do with this, and what about that? Because those people, they deal with us. If I want advice, I'm not talking about Al-Anons in recovered Al-Anons. They deal with us. If I want to know how to handle a situation in a relationship, ask the Al-Anon. They're professionals. So I love that. So I'm like, oh, this will be great. I'm going to steal the material. I'm going to get some, you know, go there, soak some stuff up. Now, so it's mixed. And one of the other speakers there, and her name was Marie, and she's like wonderful. Her husband's an alcoholic. She's an Al-Anon. She's an incredible big book thumper. Her husband was sponsored by Don P. You know, she's from Colorado. So I'm like, love this. She's my roommate. I'm happy as a clam, right? Well, I kept noticing that all the alcoholics were scattered in the smoking area, all along the periphery. And these women kept following me around all weekend long, like little clusters of ducks. And I'm looking, and I'm like outside smoking, just trying to be quiet. I hate people. I don't interact. Like, I just want to smoke. Leave me alone. And they're fucking following me. And I'm going and like trying to sit at a table quietly. And they, oh, what do you think about this? And I'm looking and I'm going, every single one of these are an Al-Anon. The alcoholics are scattered being antisocial like myself. And the Al-Anons are like hunting me down. And I'm sitting here and I'm like, this is really interesting. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm their drug. Holy shit, that's what's going on here. I'm their fucking drug and they're following me. I was like, probably the first time I really got what it was to be an Al-Anon, because I'm watching this and they're just like getting close. They're touching me. I'm like, don't fucking touch me. Get off me. You know, and very nice, very sweet, gentle little ladies. And I'm like, you're touching me. Stop touching me. I'm in New York. Just don't touch me. Get away from me. Don't make eye contact with me. What is wrong with you people? They're Al-Anon. And I'm like, holy shit. You know, stealing. And that's the thing. It's like they and I'm like, wow, they like my alcoholic crazy energy. That's what's going on here. Oh, that's it, man. Of course, they're recovered Al-Anon. So they want to be by the recovered alcoholics, but they still like the crazy alcoholic energy, you know. So, but the thing is, and this is the thing, is that these very same principles that these people are using in their lives are the very things that we need to be using in ours, because they're, one, they're the same principles that we are applying, but they're more detailed and more dealing with personal interaction, you know. And it's the interpersonal interaction where alcoholics, we often stumble. Because we are blocked by our fear, because we have all these insecurities, because we have this natural state of unworthiness that we kind of drag around with us. And we do this work and we get this God, this connection and this stuff, and we're really rocking and rolling, but really all of us are still awkward teenagers. I mean, think about all the alcoholics you know, right? And how wonderful they are and all the 12-step work they do and how great they could be with the book and how great they could be working with a newcomer. And then think about, like, watching them, like, you know, at a dance or like at a club, and they're like awkward and weird, and they'll make eye contact and they twitch a little bit, right? We all do that. You know, not necessarily amongst each other, but like when we're separated from the herd, forget it. Like we're like, you know, a little off in that area. Or we do that bravado thing where like we act like we swagger, but deep down inside we're like, you know.
Swagger.
We swagger, but we all know we're compensating for something, right?
Right.
So the thing is that, you know, we have that natural state, and it does get better. I mean, over the past 18 years, it's certainly gotten better. I certainly couldn't have sat up, you know, I couldn't be doing what I do with the big book and the workshops and the conferences if it hadn't, on some level, you know, gotten better. But we still are working at some, on some degree of a deficit. Because think about how badly, how much we hump inventory just to be okay. You know? It's like, I don't know how many times people have come up to me in the years, and somebody asked me just recently, no offense, but what type of inventory do you use? The big book, man. Like, well, what version of it? Well, lots. Like, you know, like all different kinds. Like, whatever, you know, whatever inventory fits that specific resentment or that specific circumstance or that time frame for that matter. You know, it's like I have a lot of tools in my box. Like, I can use all different kinds of stuff. You know, but it's like we want to find that perfect inventory. We want to find that magic bullet that makes us normal. Guess what? Don't happen. You know, I've met a lot of these, and you guys have met them too, a lot of these, like, you know, big book gods, my heroes. They're awkward, weird dudes. Seriously. They're creepy, some of them. They're weird. They're awkward. You know, he thought Mark Houston was a newcomer when he met him. Tried to 12-step him in the lobby of the, what was it, the Hilton or the Marriott? The lobby of the Marriott by
LaGuardia
in
Airport.
Queens. He's like, oh, dude, you look scared. You all right? You know, it's Mark Houston. You know, I mean, think about this. How many big book demigods have you met who are on their, like, third marriage? Yeah. The interpersonal relationships are the things that we struggle with the most, I think. And I think, you know, in terms of sponsorship, it's a lot easier to, you know, because the sponsorship is, you know, we have those set roles. We have, you know, I know what's expected of me and you know what's expected of you, and we work within time, the framework of those roles in that relationship.
I was told by my sponsor, we were 5 years sober, that I was not allowed to celebrate at my home group if I didn't bring my family.
Yeah, and then we brought our families and told him to do that again.
Yeah, he understood why I didn't bring my children to the meeting again.
Because he ran up, my son Seamus ran up to Dave, grabbed his leg, he's like 6'5", and was hanging on to it for dear life, you know, and wouldn't leave him alone.
He headbutted him. Nuts. but the idea behind it, I don't bring my children to meetings, but my children know about going to meetings.
What?
They know about Alcoholics Anonymous. We have meetings in our house. Yeah. We have step work done in our house. Our kids know what are going on. You know, I was telling somebody this yesterday. I remember years and years and years ago, we caught my daughter teaching my son how to meditate and pray.
Yeah, she still does the Om thing.
Yeah, you know, because they see us doing this. And the idea is we don't necessarily have to insulate them from all of this. Yes, we want to be good parents, and we don't want them to have to deal with wet, sloppy, violent drunks. We can, you know, I had a wet one. It's this chronic wanner. I can't call him a chronic relapser because he never really stopped. He wanted it all the time, so he'd show up at my house shit-faced all the time.
Hey.
Yeah, Eddie. Yeah. And I get a phone call from her.
Yeah.
Eddie's here. You know,
I come back from like picking up my kids from daycare or from preschool and food shopping, and there's a wet, sloppy drunk on my porch.
Eddie's here. I need your help. So I come home. She's got Eddie sitting in the driveway.
Yeah, I won't let him in the house.
He can't go in the house, you know, because the kids are in the house. And not in a mean way, You know, it's not like, no, you're not allowed, you're nasty. No, it's not like that. It's, you know, here, let's sit in the chair.
So I brought the kids out to the backyard.
Go play.
They played in the backyard. They were doing their thing, and we sat outside because, you know, if he got violent or if something happened and I'm in the house with the kids, I can't necessarily control the situation. Mm-hmm. But I'm outside with my cell phone and the house phone ready to call 911 if something's up. Mm-hmm. And I can get my kids away and in the house if something goes down.
Eddie had his moments, but he wasn't typically...
Eddie jumped out of a moving truck.
No, he wanted to. He didn't do it. He opened the door, but he didn't actually jump. This is really important. I didn't understand the concept of going on a 12-step call with somebody else.
Oh, yeah.
You know, anybody called me, I was there in a heartbeat. No problem. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I went on wet drunk calls by myself all the time. Okay. And it's not a good idea. It's not a good idea. And Eddie's a good example of that. We're doing 60 miles an hour down the highway in my van, going to a detox. He realizes he's going to detox and changes his mind. And he goes to open the door going 60 miles an hour down the highway. I'm driving a work van. I can't reach him. I'm going to crash. You know, it's like I got to try and grab. If you got somebody else, they can wrangle that guy.
Yeah.
You know, my old sponsor talked about walking into a wet drunk call and the guy sitting there in a chair with a bottle and a gun.
Yeah.
You know, what do you do when you're by yourself?
Well, the other thing too is, I mean, I've walked into it, and this was just happened to be a coincidence, or one of Adam's guys that worked for Adam also went to our home group, and I got a wet drunk call, and he was working with Adam, and Adam brought him back to the house, and I was going to drive him to home group, and I got a wet drunk call. One of my sponsees was, you know, messed up, and she's like, "Look, you're in the area. Can you scoop her up and bring her to the meeting? We'll meet her there, and we'll figure out what to do with her." No problem. So I have him in the car, and I pick up my sponsee. So then I have my sponsee, his employee, and myself. We go to pick up this woman, and I pull up, and her boyfriend's beating the shit out of her on her front lawn. And, you know, so now we got a domestic abuse situation. We got the cops called. You know, I got this guy. He's trying to kill her. And, of course, I'm not going to let that happen. So, I get in between, you know. I'll put myself in between this. So, I'm trying to separate these two, as you know, and get... He goes to the guy and says, "Come on, let's go over here. I know she's a bitch, but let's go talk about how she's a bitch. Let me get her over here." You know, and I grab her, and I'm like, "Yeah, he's an asshole. Let's go over here. Let's separate these two." You know, and so, you know, and it was like, so me, when I go into a situation, when I go into a wet drunk situation, I always bring a man. And I always bring a man because I was like, if I didn't have that, I got a mouth. The second that guy decked her in front of me, forget it. I was going to get in his face, and I was going to get my ass kicked. But, you know, because I had a guy, because I had a man with me, you know, I had like a bouncer, essentially, a bodyguard. And he was able to come in there and take care of it, and I was able to get her out of there, you know, and we got her to the meeting, we got her to a detox, and all was well. You know, and that's the other thing, too, is like up by us, we hear people, there's like, "A drunk person showed up at an AA meeting. How dare they?" We had a group conscience and threw them out.
Yeah.
Yes?
What do y'all do with people on pills?
Oh.
I get mad, especially where I'm from. I mean, these are my buddies. Like, we used to drink together a lot. Mm-hmm. They're strung out on pills and methadone, and I'm all for them. I just like, oh.
Depends on the pills.
Depends on the pills. I'm a drug addict alcoholic. I'm actually a pill head. That's my specialty. So for me, I can work with those people no problemo. You know, drug-seeking behavior, oh, God, do I know that. You know, so for me, I work with them very well because I have the common peril, common solution. So some of them I detox, some of them I detox at my house.
It depends on the substance. Some substances you really, really can't,
you know,
detox them.
A
at
heroin
all.
Detox, an opiate detox, they're annoying and they're miserable bastards, but it won't kill them.
But they're easy.
I will not detox or assist a detox with anybody who's detoxing off of alcohol or benzos. because those are where you're actually literally in medical danger. I mean, because we have the insurance system up by us really sucks, and of course, you know, the relapse rate in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the use of rehabs as a, you know, get out of jail free card, has made it so that, you know, insurance companies are really unwilling to pay. People are not able to go to detox more than a few times, and of course, we sometimes need it more than a few times. So what's been happening a hell of a lot? It's like, you know, we don't have indigent rehabs, we don't have detoxes. The few that we do have are very far away, so we end up with a lot of people without insurance or without the ability to get into a rehab or a detox, who need a detox. So one of the things that we do is we bring them to the local emergency room. If they're drunk, we get their blood alcohol. We get them drunker. We get them drunker. Dump them
absolutely.
There.
Absolutely. You. The idea is you don't bring an alcoholic who's only half drunk.
Or no, just, you get
you know,
really
coming
wrecked.
Down ready to detox and bring them to a hospital. They'll get turned away.
Yes.
What you do is you get them a bottle of 151 and you get them fucking plowed.
Yes.
You know? and then
you
what you do?
You pour them into the detox.
You bring them into the emergency room and you tell the nurse this guy's prone to seizures.
Yes. Or they tell them you're suicidal.
Yeah. Well, suicide. I don't like that. I know it works in a pinch. It'll work to tell them you're suicidal. But the problem is if you tell them you're suicidal, you're detoxing on the flight deck.
Well, the other thing too is, you know what? We're being terrible because we're telling you how to
manipulate
dope
the system.
So please ignore this. No. But we bring them to the local hospital. We have them evaluated. We abandon them.
Yeah.
Don't stay.
Yeah, don't
because
stay.
Because once their blood alcohol level starts to drop, they'll make you take
them
home.
Off on you.
No, you leave them there. Because if they don't have a ride and they can't walk,
the hospital
they
can't
have to
them.
Keep them. So that's one of the things that we do, especially with alcohol. With benzos, I won't detox. I'll do the same thing. With the benzos, a lot of times I'll have them drink only a little bit because benzos and booze together can actually kill you. But they have to have some alcohol in their system as well. So I'll give them a beer and throw them to the detox. And I'm talking a beer on the ride, too. Yeah. And bring them to the hospital. But I won't detox those two things. But if I have a junkie, you know, or an opiate addict.
They're whiners, but
I'll feed them on my couch, give them, you know, tomato soup, and let them whine like the bitches they are. I don't really have a problem with that. Although the last one we detoxed on my couch stole my engagement ring and my wedding ring.
Yeah,
so.
That's another thing here. I want to talk about this one a little bit. You know,
because, hey, I'm an opiate addict.
You know what? To be perfectly honest, I don't care. You know, I'm fine with it. You know, I was pissed when I realized it. You know, yeah. we've been robbed a number of times by.
Yeah, well, we okay. But we don't figure it out for a little while.
Yeah,
we're not that bright.
We don't know where shit is. You know, but when I finally figured it out, you know, I was
yeah.
Mad.
Every piece of my yellow, I like white gold or platinum. But you know, I had like, you know, quite a few pieces of yellow gold, like back when he used to make a whole lot of money. He made a whole lot of money at one point. I had a lot of jewelry. It was sort of an investment, and every single piece of yellow gold was robbed from me. And I figured it out like the Christmas actually, because I went to go put on my jewelry, and I didn't have any.
But the point I want to make on this though. Is the benefits that we get from doing this far outweigh any of those financial repercussions that happen? It's happened, you know, three times over 18 years.
Yeah, twice was my engagement ring, two engagement rings.
Yeah, you know.
I don't know what's that.
The only one that I held on to for a really long time, I had to write a lot of inventory on it, was that this fucking crackhead stole my daughter's piggy bank.
Yeah, that bothered me.
You know, that bothered me. That so, really did. The jewelry and all. We're making this decision. We're signing up for this type of lifestyle. My kids didn't. You
know? And that's when we made the rules.
And that bothered. That's when we started to make the rules.
And we started with the boundaries. And this is what we're talking about, the communication. You know, okay, something happens. We make a bad decision, or maybe we make an uninformed decision. So then we can make, we can say, and it's not, the, you know, we make, we say, okay, well, this, these are the qualifications. So not everybody who calls me up and says, I need a place to stay, I need to detox, can detox at my house.
Mm-hmm.
I won't detox strangers anymore. I just won't do it. You know, a friend of a friend of a friend needs a detox? No. I'm sorry. You know, so there's certain things that I, certain boundaries that I set, and that's the thing, and this is, we're talking about living service. Boundaries. Alcoholics, we have none. We have no boundaries, and therefore we don't believe anybody else has any boundaries or has any right to boundaries, because we have none.
Or we're on the flip side and we have too many.
And we have so many, we're like grizzly fucking porcupines, and all we do is, you know, push people away, and we have such impenetrable boundaries that we're like the most impossible people to deal with.
And part of it, you know, we've been talking, you know, outside, we've been talking a lot about qualifying people. And I use that same kind of principle when we're dealing with wet ones and people who we bring into our home.
Yeah.
You know, we have that initial approach,
yeah,
you know, with these people. We don't tell them you're going to be able to stay. You know, come on over, let's talk.
Yeah.
You know, let's hang out for an afternoon, and we'll see where you're at and what's going on. Well, and you get a vibe, and you start to get a feel for it. You know, we're alcoholics, we're drug addicts. We know the bullshit. You know, you're not going to pull it over on us. You know, so the idea is we know the manipulative behavior.
Yeah.
You know, and once you show that, you're done. You know, if you're sincere, and you know, I may not know you personally, but I know your sponsor or somebody who whatever, and we have this conversation. You know what? He's cool. Yeah. We can handle this for a couple days. You know, no problem.
Yeah, and so, you know, over the years when we've detoxed quite a few people at our house, we've run a somewhat unofficial. We actually have a vacancy for the first time in
a long time.
A long time, actually. our last one just moved out. He found a girlfriend. And that was about 2 months ago. Very happy.
Yeah, he's with the. He met this girl 6 weeks, and he's moving in.
I was good luck with that.
Your room's there.
The point
is, typical alcoholic, you know.
But the point is that when we almost always have somebody, and we almost always do this. I mean, we have a 5-bedroom house. We have access to space. We have the room to do this, so we do it. We choose well. We don't people please. If we're uncomfortable with the situation, we cut it off at the knees. We set boundaries. We communicate. And it really, and it does help, because there are people that, you know, Steve's a perfect example. He was somebody who could not get sober. He could not stay away from a drink. He could not stay stopped. He couldn't stay stopped long enough to write a four-step. You know, we took him. We babysat him.
He stopped drinking in the middle of his fifth step. Yeah, we were. He wasn't living with us yet. He wasn't doing it. He was doing the, you know, drink, stay sober for a day or two.
Write
in that
inventory.
day or two, he wrote some inventory. You know, and then he'd drink, and then he'd stay sober for a day or two, do some more inventory, and we're sitting there hashing this out, and it was like I was telling you guys yesterday about the two columns. You know, just column one and column two. He's coming over with these two columns. He can't get through this. Yeah, you know, it took like three sit downs to get through his stuff before he actually stopped.
Yeah.
You know.
Yes.
During this process, did y'all like allow him to drink at your house?
Maybe. Nobody can drink at our house
except my dad.
we don't give people alcohol at our house except for the non-alcoholics. So, for example, my parents can drink at our house, but I don't give alcoholics alcohol at my house. Your dad drinks in the yard.
Yeah, my
dad's an alcoholic who, if he doesn't drink, he does go through withdrawals. So,
and he'll come and visit every couple of years, but he doesn't actually stay inside.
No, he sleeps in our yard.
He's a homeless guy.
He's
been homeless for 20 years.
So we give him a tent. He sleeps in our yard because he can't be indoors. Literally, he gets claustrophobic in a house.
Yeah, so
he
doesn't want to. Yeah, you know, he
we
really
tried.
I've talked to him about it, and he's happy with his life.
Yeah.
You know, his stomach's out to here. He's kind of yellow. Yeah, he's Arlo Guthrie. Or Woody Guthrie,
sorry.
You know, but he's, you know, I tried the 12-step, and you know, bad move again. Another.
Yeah,
another,
do not 12-step family. You
it's
have
really
friends, goddammit.
It's hard, man.
Get them to do it. Seriously.
Yeah. It's really hard because what it is there's an emotional attachment that you can't get past. I don't give a shit how good you are at this. You can't get past this emotional attachment.
My brother was terrorizing down. Was it Bruton?
Dover.
My brother was terrorizing downtown Dover drunk with no shoes. So my mother calls me up because she knows this is what I do. We are the EMS service in our family for all of the drunks and junkies. So we get the phone call and it's, you know, Jimmy's wandering around Dover with no shoes and drunk. We don't really know where he is, but we think he's by ShopRite. Can you go get him? This is like 45 minutes from our house. Sure. He drops everything, goes to get my brother. And I think I'm pregnant. Was I big enough, big old and pregnant at the time?
I don't know.
I think I'm big old and pregnant, like waddling around at this point. So he goes and picks up my brother and he brings him back to the house, but he's doing this meeting.
I'm working with the guys at the rehab up the hill, and it's not a rehab, it's like a
therapeutic community.
It's a therapeutic community, but once you hit phase two, you can leave with your sponsor.
Yeah, so he's been stealing guys out of this place and bringing them back to our house to do big book studies, right? So he's like kidnapping them.
I go up the mountain, I pick these guys up, I load up the van, I drive down the mountain, and there's a liquor store at the bottom of the mountain. I walk into the liquor store, I buy a bottle, you know, because Jimmy's detoxing on my couch.
So he's got my drunk brother, my drunk brother in the living room watching Teletubbies with my son. Me, like about 7 months pregnant, you know, like waddling around the house. And my brother's so drunk he can't even stand, so he's leaning on me. And I'm trying to get him up the deck into my living room. Because Adam just dumps him. He's like, I got to go get the guys. So he goes and grabs the guys, brings the guys back to the house. They're reading the big book. And I'm just trying to keep my brother entertained long enough so that he can get through this 1 hour with these guys. So he can go bring them back to the rehab so then he can bring my brother to the detox, right? So we're doing this, and I'm, you know, my brother, and so, you know, he's starting to go through withdrawal. So, like, you know, we let him, you know, drink a beer in the yard, you know, because, like, not in the house, you know, but I'm not going to have you have a seizure also in my living room. So he's sitting in a lawn chair in the yard drinking a beer, right? And Adam dumps the guys off the detox. He picks up my brother. He brings him to detox. I get a call 2 days later from T, and T needs to go to detox. So now I'm doing the run this time. He's bringing my parents to LaGuardia with my parents.
I'm at LaGuardia Airport. I got to bring this guy to detox. And I was like, what are you, nuts? I can't.
So I grab a bottle of booze and I go out to T. I'm like, T, Adam's at LaGuardia. So like I got 2 hours until he comes home, you know, until he can watch the kids. So I can go bring T to detox. I'm going to give you this bottle. Sit here and don't do anything. So I send one of his sponsees, Aunt, over to T. I said, babysit him, don't let him leave. So he comes home, I scoop up T. So now my brother's in the same detox. So now I come with T, I bring T. So T decides that he's going to do some heroin because he wants a box zone on his detox because he doesn't want a detox not high. So I get T to detox. T gets there. His blood pressure is like 210 over 180. He's ready to stroke out on booze and dope. I'm like, holy shit. I had no idea. So he's
walking around
red.
Functioning.
Yeah, he's talking to everybody. I'm like, fuck. I go to the nurse. I'm like, is that what I think it is? He's like, holy shit. He's going to freaking stroke. So, like, I get T there. So T is now in detox with my brother. So my brother gets out of detox. He picks him up, brings him home. I bring T. Like, this rehab looks, that they're looking at us going, you know, I mean, because this is just the place where we bring everybody.
It's the only one left in New Jersey that deals with indigent care.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's St. Clair's in Booton. It's the only hospital that'll deal with indigent care. Only thing you got to do is you tell them you live on the street in Morristown.
So we're constantly in and out of this place all the time. They're like, dude, hey, oh, who do you got? Shit. Them?
You again?
Weren't you here last week? Yes. Yeah, mm-hmm. But I mean, but this is the thing. It's like, you know, this is what we do. So yeah, sometimes it's, but you know, ultimately, my brother calls he deals with it. He gets one of his guys. He got Ant. Was it Ant who was dealing with Jimmy?
But
he got his consie to deal with my brother.
I like Jimmy. Yeah. I have no problem.
So we don't 12-step family. I mean, we don't. Like, again, I've been asked by my family to detox a couple of our heroin addicts because, you know, we're good like that.
We'll do the mechanics of the detox, but you can't work with them.
No.
Like, do the step work with them.
We zig our sponsees and our friends. We're like, look, I got a nephew here. And we run away. Deal with him. It's not my problem. It's not, because, you know, I can't control. I'm going to want to control the outcome of that. Mm-hmm. And it ain't my place. So it's like, here, you're in some good hands. I'm over here. Hey, you know, and I won't. I won't 12-step them, but I will introduce them. And when I'm detoxing them, if I have to do that, and I have detoxed some family members, they're on the couch, and they're surrounded by our people, and we're not involved.
Mm-hmm. When I picked up Jimmy from that train station, I didn't talk to him about stuff.
No.
You know, I seen him sitting there on the step, and I flipped through my CD player or my MP3 player, and I found Van Morrison. And I put on Van Morrison just as soon as I pulled up. He got in the car and he nodded.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not gonna work with you. I'm gonna help you. I'm gonna get you to the hospital. I'm gonna do that kind of stuff. But I can't work with you.
Yeah.
You know, and I paid the price with my dad. I tried working with my dad.
Tried 12-stepping your dad.
And I almost got high. I ended up going places that I wouldn't go with a drunk. You know, I ended up doing things I wouldn't do with a drunk. I followed him around New York City and let him lead the situation, trying to talk to him, trying to manipulate him into a meeting or into a... No, you can't work like that with alcohol. It's you take the lead.
Yeah.
You know, but with family members, it's that emotional, I'll do whatever it
We're
takes.
We're so invested in saving them.
To help
them.
You, I'm going to give up what I know to be right.
So we don't do that. And that's the thing is, that's why we have friends. That's why we have sponsees. That's why we have sponsors. Because when people contact me, when family members, because I'm full of them, I have an entire family full of drug addicts and alcoholics who almost all of them are in some stage of their disease. You know, when they need the help, I mean, I don't do it. I give them to my friends. And this is why we have them. And this is part of the humility, you know, too, is that, you know, we want to present to AA, you know, to the outside world that we're always perfect and our family's always great and we never have any problems. That's not the case. I mean, that's why we're here. You know, and that's why we have the accountability that we have. That, you know, so you know, my network, the people that are closest to me, my 10-step buddies, they all know about my brother. They all know about my nephew. They all know about the other nephew. They all know about this stuff. So when I call and I say, yo, you know, Justin needs a detox again. You know, he drove head-on into a truck and broke his back, his hip. This was last month. No, 2 months ago.
2 months ago.
You know, what do you got? They know exactly what I'm talking about because they've held me accountable to my emotional attachments to this. Because that's the thing is, like, you know, we all have attachments. We all have characters that we play. We all have, you know, that theater of the lie going on within us at any given point because we all, you know, it's hard to make yourself not want things. You know, I mean, we all, you know, what I want doesn't matter. But it doesn't say, what I want doesn't matter says that I have to not give power to my wants, but it doesn't say that I don't want.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it's human to want things. And one of the things that, one of the disciplines that I've been working with for so long is learning to not want my wants. To want something and say, yeah, I want that, that would be nice, but that's not how it is. Move on. Next. The Tao of whatever, or it be what it is. I mean, I'm being snarky, but this is something that I truly, truly am working with. You know, because I want my family members to have what I have. I want people to experience the joy and freedom I have. I love them, so it would be natural for me to want them to have the joy that I have. But just because I love them doesn't mean that I have the right to dictate their life. Just because I know that there's an answer doesn't mean that I can impose that on them. You know, and that's where, you know, to the wives. and the family afterward are so incredibly important in our relationships. Because again, it goes back to that interpersonal relationship, that interaction that alcoholics, we, you know, it took me forever to be able to say what I wanted or say what I needed without saying it in a way that was, you know, critical. Mm-hmm. You know, that whole mean, say what you mean and mean what you say, but don't say it mean. Well, I knew that I was supposed to do that, but I didn't know how to do that.
The line in there that says don't criticize doesn't mean you don't say what you want.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the methodology and the way you say it.
Exactly.
She got given me a suggestion of not criticizing me at one point.
So I didn't say anything.
She didn't say anything was wrong.
Because I was really angry.
You know. Never told me what was wrong. Never told me what I was doing that was unacceptable. You know, and I continue to do this shit, and everything's hunky-dory in my mind.
And I'm writing inventory till my fingers bleed because I'm not supposed to be angry and I'm not supposed to criticize. So I just keep trying to keep writing inventory these resentments away, thinking that if I found the perfect inventory, it would all go away because I'm not supposed to criticize and I'm not supposed to be angry.
What we found is when there's a point in your day or in your week or in your month or whatever, when you're both connected and spiritually grounded, everything's cool, have a conversation. Have a talk about the appropriate way to bring up something that might push buttons.
Exactly. Yeah. How would if I'm having an issue, how would you like me to approach you?
You know, so that I'm not defensive when she says something to me.
Yeah.
You know, basically, honey, are you okay to hear something right now? It's that simple.
Yeah.
But have that conversation before so you both know you're on the same page.
You know, we need a common ground and we need ground rules. You need boundaries and ground rules for how to interact with one another, because not everybody is going to react like me or think like me, and I can't read your mind anymore, because when I play mind reading games, I begin to believe that I'm God. So I have to be humble and ask questions like, you know, like I was talking about it yesterday. It's like, you know, if I'll be talking or interacting with somebody and I'm a snark. And I'm not snark in a nasty way, but sometimes, you know, I say things and I don't realize how wrong they are. And I'm like, ooh, that was pretty wrong. Uh-oh. And I'll see a look on somebody's face, and I don't know if it was wrong, like I offended them, or they're just like, you know. So I'll say, you know, did I offend you with that? That simple. Mm-hmm. No. Okay, cool. We're good. Boom. But, you know, as an alcoholic, I don't want to ask questions. I don't want to be vulnerable. I'm full of fear. I don't want people to think I don't know everything. I don't want to appear insecure. Well, dude, we appear insecure all the fucking time anyway, because we're always insecure because we're alcoholics. That's our natural goddamn state. And unless we're absolutely hooked in and juiced up, we appear insecure all the time. I know I am. So the point is that, you know, why not be humble and say, you know, gee, you know, when I said that, did it offend you? Or when you see something going on with somebody, say, you know, is everything okay? You seem a little off. You know, and we ask these questions, you know, because I'll see something going on with somebody and I'll start reading into it thinking it's me because I'm so freaking important. I'm the center of the universe. And all of a sudden I'm attributing things and making things out of situations or things that didn't exist because I read something on your face, and because I'm so egotistical, I didn't bother to ask you if you farted. So anyway, so why don't we take a break on that one?
Good place to stop.